There's very limited experimental evidence to go one way or the other. But theoretically, the way that I've heard them discuss it is about, you know, 20% before you get the mass of a black hole, your neutron star is pretty much guaranteed to become incredibly unstable and just kind of erupt. Again, this is probably modeling because there's very few experimental ways of proving any of this. So, you know, just the same way as no one's looked inside a black hole, I don't even know how you're going to do it. Because an event horizon is kind of a one-way gate, as far as I could figure.
In the case of a helium atom, for instance, where the neutrons and protons are packed together, that's the nucleus, and the nucleus is an extremely dense object. It has 10^5 difference in diameter. In other words, the diameter of the nucleus is 100,000 times smaller than the average diameter of the electron cloud around it. So most of that helium atom is really empty space. But by the time you get into that nucleus, it's very tightly packed. And so now if I have nothing but protons that have had electrons frozen into them and they become neutrons, and the neutrons are also there, I used to think that the nucleus of a helium atom is packed about as tight as you can get it, and now this neutron degeneracy you're talking about with a neutron star, the word you're using would lead me to believe that it's squeezing a little bit more than the nucleus of a helium atom, for instance. But do you think it really could degenerate, that it could squeeze together all the way to a so-called singularity, where its dimension goes from something that's kind of small toward zero? The fact that somebody's come up with theory on that doesn't convince me that it's reality. Over to you, Roy, KQIW.
Well, I could understand your disbelief, and I read these things, and every so often I shrug. But I mean, just as an example of how things don't seem to be the way they seem to should, you would think that a helium nucleus is very dense and very small. And if you take something like a uranium nucleus, has a lot more protons, has a lot more neutrons, it should be a lot bigger than a helium nucleus. But in fact, they're almost the same size. So it only goes to show that even though they're tightly bound together, they could even be more tightly bound together.
Okay, there's one other thing that's giving me some trouble here. Pulsars as a timing device are extremely accurate. A pulsar is a kind of a neutron star that goes through a certain number of revolutions per second, so to speak. And that revolutions per second is a very steady number. For that number to be that steady, when it's emitting that much energy, it has a very large moment of inertia. If it really was a pure singularity, it would have zero moment of inertia, and it wouldn't have that stability. So the observation of the huge stability of pulsars leads me to believe that neutron stars of the size of a pulsar don't have zero moment of inertia. Therefore, they've got a real distribution that is not a singularity from that evidence. That's a theory. Over to you, Roy. KQIW.
I don't think anyone suggested that neutron stars are singularities. It's when the mass increases to the point that they become black holes that things become very weird. But as they are neutron stars, they definitively don't have a singularity. They are an object with an incredibly dense, high density, but they're a spheroid-like object rotating with a very, very fast angular momentum, because it's an entire sun that's been shrunk down to basically about 15 miles. So all that angular momentum of a star is going into a very small sphere.
Is there any evidence of a black hole that is a pulsar? so, then what I'm talking about is worth discussing further. I think there are some black holes that are pulsars. Over to you.
I don't think a black hole per se can be a pulsar, because the only radiation that a black hole on a theoretical basis that I'm aware of is Hawking's radiation, which it's not really a pulsar. Quasars are generated from the accretion disk around black holes. But I'm not aware of a pulsar that's believed to be a black hole. I'll do some further research.
There are some black hole-like objects, whether they're not completely black hole, I'm not sure, which are squirting out a tremendous amount of energy from the North Pole and the South Pole, and some of that energy that they're squirting out is coming out at close to the speed of light. Therefore, I see the possibility that one of those could be a pulsar. Very rare, but I see the possibility. Maybe I'm misinterpreting those things that are squirting out energy from the North and the South Pole. Over to you, Roy.
I would assume that it has to be an external phenomenon beyond the event horizon, because as we've both been discussing, the escape velocity of electromagnetism would not allow it to escape the event horizon, and so it wouldn't be perceivable. So I'm still thinking that there's some accretion disk that's nearby that's fueled this phenomenon. Again, I'll research it, because I love to look these things up. But I don't think that the black hole itself, other than Hawking's radiation, is capable of any emission. And Hawking's radiation is a very complicated subject that really requires an understanding of quantum gravity that we don't really have. Even Stephen Hawking kind of fudges it around the edges.
I believe Hawking radiation is a very small radiation, that it would take a zillion years for a black hole to evaporate by that means. And I think it also only evaporates rapidly as it's near the end of its evaporation, when it's a threshold black hole. You've got Paul, K2LAW.
Yeah, the pulsars are really emitting the magnetic field, you know, when they collapse. I think it's the cube of whatever it used to be to the radius of the whole pulsar. So, you know, you're talking about a magnetic field compared to the black holes are actually emitting a substance probably from the event horizon. You know, if it was below that, it wouldn't be getting out, you know, from the North and South Pole. Back to you, Roy.
We're fairly sure that some of the black holes have to be rotating. The next question now, Roy, is can a magnetic field come out of a black hole? AC2GS, K2LAW in the group.
I would agree that most people think that most black holes have angular momentum, but I again can't theoretically see any way that magnetic fields can go outside of the event horizon. Magnetic fields are mediated by electromagnetism. Electromagnetism escape velocity isn't strong enough for it to get past the event horizon, so you're stuck once again.
So if two neutron stars each have strong magnetic fields, they're magnetars, so to speak, and they combine and make a black hole, where did all those magnetic fields go?
The same place all that mass went. It's someplace inside that event horizon, doing who knows what. Hawking's will tell you collapsing into some kind of very strange point source. There's all kinds of wonderful theories of what's going on behind the event horizon. I personally have no clue, but it's something definitely strange going on. But if you can imprison mass, why can't you imprison photons?
Okay. You and I are fairly sure that rotational kinetic energy with a black hole has to be a reality. But if it's a singularity with zero dimension, how does it maintain conservation of rotational kinetic energy? Over to you, Roy.
Now, again, personally, have no clue. But if I wanted to play semantics with you, I could say that the singularity might not have an angular momentum, but the event horizon might have an angular momentum.
Okay. The only thing that can have angular momentum is something that has mass. If a lot of the mass is in the event horizon, that to me is not a singularity. That's a that's the equivalent of a thin shell of Earth where all of the mass is in the thin shell and nothing is inside. If you could do that with the Earth and you climbed inside, you would be in weightlessness. Over to you, Roy.
This sort of bleeds over another topic that I'll get to soon, but photons can have angular velocity and they're rest massless.
Is that what you mean by the spin? Does a photon have spin? Is it one half a spin, so to speak?
Fermions, electrons, protons, and neutrons have a one-half spin. Photons have a whole number, a one spin.
Okay. If they have a spin of one, do they have angular momentum? Do they have moment of inertia? Do they have angular momentum? And if they have zero mass, that sounds like a conflict.
You'd think so, but you know that photons have momentum because we've talked about it before, how the solar mass was planned to use that type of solar pressure even beyond the solar winds. So they do have momentum. So if you apply the momentum in an angular direction, they have angular velocity. I mean, that's why I was going to do the story of scientists are trying to figure out a good reason why the photosphere of the sun is spinning much less than the rest of the sun, and what exactly is slowing it down. And their best theory this week is that the photons that are being given off in the photosphere actually have coupled the angular velocity, angular momentum, and are bleeding it away and slowing down the surface of the sun. So this week they believe that photons can have angular velocity.
So photons have angular velocity and they have momentum. But are they having momentum with zero mass? That is a conflict, Roy. Go ahead.
Well, the semantic trick, I guess, is that they have zero rest mass. They might have inertial equivalent mass when they're doing their thing at the speed of light. But if you stop a photon, it ceases to exist, so its mass is zero. Its rest mass is zero. So you can fudge the concept of mass and rest mass and such, but if it didn't have momentum, how would the radiometer work?
Okay, if my photon is moving at the speed of light, can I give it a mass number? I mean, we have really measured the amount of momentum that photons have. You can take all the photons coming out of that sun that hit your 1 square meter of material you're holding in front of our atmosphere at the Earth's distance, 93 million miles, you can measure that number of newtons of, it's millinewtons of force, or is it micro? Wait a minute now. It's in units of, I think it's in micropascals. You can measure 46 micropascals per meter. That's the photon force of the light coming out of the sun, the photons out of the sun. So they have a measurable amount of momentum when they hit my absorbing material, 1 square meter of it. So therefore, they have real apparent mass when they're moving, and they only exist when they're moving. Therefore, if we're going to talk about the mass of a photon, we should always talk about its moving mass at the speed of light, so to speak. Over to you, Roy. KQRIW.
I assume that you could calculate an inertial mass equivalency, because you can calculate the momentum, E equals H nu, Planck's constant times frequency equals energy, G is in this case is momentum, and then divide that by the speed of light. And I guess that would give you a number. I don't know exactly what you do with it, but it would give you a number for an inertial equivalent mass. That would be the way I would think it would be done.
Yeah, you can Google with Wikipedia what is the amount of pressure you get from solar radiation, photon pressure. And it's rated in I think it's micropascals. And I think the number was 46 micropascals, which is 46 newtons per square meter. So it has a measurable amount of pressure. That really means it's got a measurable amount of momentum, measurable amount of mass. So a moving photon seems to have a measurable amount of mass, because we can calculate how many photons are hitting one square meter at the Earth's distance from the sun. Over to you, Roy.
It becomes a game of semantics. A lot of times physicists will start to talk about rest mass. They don't particularly like talking about inertial mass equivalence, because they add adjectives and adverbs all over the place to qualify it. So I get the sense they're very uneasy about talking about proper mass for a photon. But that's sort of the way that I see it as, that there's an equivalent inertia in photons that disappears as soon as you stop them. So there's no residual mass, and so that's why some people call it rest mass, and other people just don't like to discuss it in public.
I've got a guess as to why they want to call it rest mass, Roy. If you and I took electrons, protons, or whatever in a particle accelerator, like the LHC, as we approach the speed of light in that particle accelerator, the apparent mass goes to infinity. So therefore, talking about the mass at the speed of light becomes impossible for real particles like protons and neutrons and your quarks and hadrons and whatever. However, a photon is not a real particle. If it only exists at the speed of light, that's the one place where you take the exception, where you don't talk about its rest mass, you talk its speed of light mass, because that's the only way it exists. If you could put a photon in that LHC and accelerate it, I don't think it would take, because it's got no charge, we can't make it go into a circle by using the magnetic field. So you can't accelerate a photon in an LHC. But because it only exists at the speed of light, that's the one exception where you really talk about its non-rest mass. That's a guess. Okay, Roy.
Repeater, time out.
You've got it, Roy.
Well, yeah, anything, I mean, if you take a look at anything that's theoretically thought to have a zero rest mass, all of them travel at the speed of light. The theoretical graviton, photons, I'm not quite sure what gluons do. I don't know. But if it has no rest mass, then it can only go at one speed, and that's the speed of light. You can't increase it because there's nothing faster than that. Going through space has a time limit. Causality is limited to the speed of light. With mass can be sped up close to the speed of light asymptotically, but never reach it. And objects with a zero rest mass only can exist at the speed of light. You can play games with their phase interaction so that they look like they slow down, but ultimately they're traveling somewhere at the speed of light.
Earlier you said that a magnetic field is really created by way of electromagnetic phenomena. Is a graviton also part of electromagnetic phenomena?
No. Magnetic fields, electric fields, electromagnetic fields are all mediated by photons. The photon is the energy-carrying the particle that deals with the electromagnetic force. The graviton is a theoretical mediator of gravitation. Quantum mechanic people would love to have a graviton. Relativistic people don't like it at all. They sort of think that gravity is really not a true force, but simply a curvature of space-time.
So when we look at those charts that shows you all the possible particles, is the graviton one of the objects in that chart?
Yes, it's on the list of bosons. There's usually two lists. One's a fermion and one's a boson. The bosons have a whole number spin and tend to be force carriers. So you have the photon, the graviton, the Higgs boson and such. So you would see them. It's theoretical. No one has come up with it yet because quantum gravity is an unfortunately primitive theory. Almost no one has any clue. The closest thing to a decent discussion of it is actually Hawking's radiation. And that's, again, he cut a lot of corners and played a lot of games with quantum gravity. So it's highly theoretical at this point and open for anyone who is interested in getting a Nobel Prize.
Okay, so the force created by that graviton can propagate through that event horizon of a black hole. A photon cannot. Alrighty. Is there anything that acts like a dielectric constant material to a graviton? Does the force created by a graviton always move at the speed of light, no matter what material it's going through? Over to you, Roy, K2RAW.
That's an interesting question. And I get the idea that massive items, since they warp space-time, can warp the path that gravitons take through space-time. So indirectly, mass can act as a dielectric in that sense.
Well, hold on now. The gravitational lensing effect, that when you and I look past a very heavy group of galaxies, and we're looking at a star 13 billion light years away, and we see it as multiple objects because of the gravity lensing effect, that's the bending of the electromagnetic waves, the light beam that you're looking at from that star, that very far star. But the local gravity field of that massive group of galaxies, those gravitons, maybe they haven't been slowed down. They're moving at the speed of light, and maybe gravitons always operate at the speed of light. Maybe they never get slowed down. Because if they did get slowed down in that gravitational lensing effect, I think you'd be getting you'd be getting the effect much stronger than what we see. That's a guess on my part. Over to you, Roy, K2RAW.
Well, my understanding is the problem is gravitational waves is not the same as gravitons. Gravitational waves will be slightly warped by the fabric of space-time. But again, you fall into kind of semantics. If space-time itself is stretched, is it really slowed down? Because it's traveling through the same thing, just in a distorted path.
If those gravitons that hit LIGO made the 4-kilometer-long path stretch and shrink by some infinitesimal amount, the speed of light going down that tunnel, if it was modulated by the same amount, then you wouldn't be disturbing the balancing of that the canceling circuit. I can't think of the name of it right now. The Wheatstone Bridge, if you know what I mean. So I'm getting the impression that the gravitational wave affected the apparent length, but not the speed of propagation. That's a guess. K2RAW.
I don't know, because it would have to be a very, 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 very small, you've looked at the specs of LIGO. LIGO, of course, is not designed to detect gravitons. They're designed to detect gravitational waves, which are considerably different. They're simply the stretching and warping of space-time itself. We have no good technique to find any of the gravitons that we theoretically would love to find. So I don't know. It's very possible that gravitons per se have no dielectric, that they are simply go about their ways immune to all of this, because, you know, one of the great things about gravity is it never wears off. It's kind of the weakest force, but it's the ultimate force that kind of runs the universe.
Except for what they think is dark energy. Okay. You don't get gravity without gravitons. And you don't get gravitational waves without modulating gravity. So it sounds to me like gravitons are mixed into those gravitational waves, Roy. Go ahead.
Well, again, it depends on who you talk to. If you talk to quantum mechanics people, or if you talk to relativity people. If you talk to relativity people, there's no graviton, there's no force. There's simply a space-time that's twisted and turned by mass. And the way that we see it is a pseudo-force. So they would tell you that there's no real graviton, lots of luck finding one, and they would say the LIGO experiment makes perfect sense to them, because what they're looking at is a modulation of space-time locally. That's why a big, heavy object is not going to produce any gravitational waves. You tend to need at least two bodies in motion in relation to them to each other in order to give you these fluctuations in space-time that radiate out.
So if this particular group of people does not believe in gravitons, does that mean that that chart of all the particles, they think that the graviton element of that chart should be removed? Is that what they're advocating?
They usually don't spend too much time in quantum mechanics. The problem is that there's two massively big fields in physics. There's a general and special relativity that explains big objects. There's quantum mechanics that explain very, very small objects. And when the two of these guys get together, it leads to confusion, which is going to be a subject of yet another little news item I have in store.
Maybe it's time you go on to your next news item, Roy. Maybe we're stuck on this one long enough.
I'll move on to a related topic. There's a group of people who want to do a new experiment on the space station. I think they call it the Quest. Quantum Entanglement for Space Experiments. What they would like to do is set up an experiment where they take some photons up and entangle them on the Earth and shoot them up at the space station with some very, very, very accurate interferometers, and then shoot a pair of non-entangled photons, and they want to see if the gravitational force is any different. A lot of times physicists tend to like to play with gravity. They like to see if gravity works in very, very, very small distances. They'd like to test gravity in very large distances. And these guys would like to use the space station to test on whether entangled photons have any different gravitational forces acting on them.
I can't think of the guy's name, a heavyset guy who way back in 18-something or other measured the gravitational constant with two very large masses hanging on a fiber. To your knowledge, Roy, what is the smallest mass of particles for which anyone has ever confirmed gravitational attraction between those particles? Maybe that's related. K2RIW.
Well, there's been a variation on that theme. I think Paul mentioned that there was an ISS experiment where they took two objects of different density and put it in a correcting electric field to see if the pro-gravity effects and the free fall would act differently. Those were rather big, relatively big cylinders. Recently, they did a very interesting experiment where they basically shot neutrons at a helium nucleus, which I guess is about as small as you're going to get, because up until then, they were only able to measure the gravitational force in terms of microns. Up until about 5-10 years ago, it was only in terms of milliliters, but they got it down to microns. Now, with this experiment with the helium nucleus, they got them down to nanometers. So that probably takes the record for the shortest distance and the lightest masses.
Were the particles they were shooting at the helium nucleus charged particles? If they were charged particles and the nucleus is charged, now you're getting all kinds of electrostatic effects, repulsion and attraction, depending on the charge polarity. If the particles you're accelerating were uncharged, then how did you accelerate them? Over to you, Roy, KQIW.
It's a good question, and I wish I knew. If I recall, they were neutrons that they were shooting at them. How they collimated them, I don't know. Again, I'll look it up, because that's a good question as any. You know, a lot of these tests get to be very esoteric and very, very big words with a lot of syllables. And, you know, sometimes I kind of run out of figuring out how these things work. But I believe it was neutrons that they were shooting. I realize it's much more difficult to target neutrons, but apparently they found some kind of trick to do it.
Comment about collimation.
Sure, Wes.
You have a 10-inch large disk with hundreds of holes and a thickness of 5 millimeters, and you shoot neutrons on. You could also use it for non-mass-containing particles, like photons, and that would be for gamma radiation and to exchange.
Okay, Wes, again, I don't know the details. I'm sure they're in the archive someplace in minute detail, because I'm sure they were very, very proud of their device. But I didn't write down any notes, so I don't know exactly how they actually targeted the neutrons. But to me, that's about the lightest I think you're going to get for a time. Nucleuses and neutrons, they're kind of the light things most guys have to play with these days.
The major point is that when you have a parallel holes in the plate, then there is no way but through the holes. And from the other side of the plate, you have a parallel stream of weather particles or photons and to exchange.
What I think Wes is saying, to put it in other words, if I've got a source of neutrons and a long enough distance between the source and the mask that he's describing, and the mask has an aperture that's small enough, everything that gets through that aperture from that long distance is, by definition, almost collimated. You're losing an awful lot of efficiency in that process, but what gets left over is at least collimated. And so, as long as you've got a method of generating neutrons, you've got a way of performing that experiment. The problem is that the nucleus of a helium atom is an extremely strong, small target. And you're going to get, once per 10 years an intercept. When you take particles that are extremely carefully focused in the clockwise direction in the Large Hadron Collider, and you take another group of particles that are extremely well focused in the counterclockwise direction, and you want them to hit each other, the vast majority of them, even though they're carefully focused, they miss. They're extremely small targets. So cross-sectional area of the target is a huge problem in these cases. Over to you, Roy, KQIW.
With you, and usually it requires a bunch of very, very clever guys to figure out a very, very clever experiment where you can kind of just about get by on something that sounds as though it's going to be impossible. But again, they somehow did it, and of course, like all the tests in the past that have wanted desperately to have a different gravitational constant, because there's a lot of people out there who want to explain dark matter and dark energy a lot, and one of the ways they want to explain it is that gravity works differently at different distances. So they want to prove that it works differently at very short distances, and use that as an excuse for looking if it works differently at very large distances. But this experiment showed the same thing as every other experiment about gravity, that the gravitational constant is a constant, no matter what, at least in nanometers. I guess if you can get it down to Planck's length, which would be a real difficult lab experiment, things might change, but I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon.
Since the gravitational constant is keeping the exact same number at nanometers, and by way of the careful navigation we've done with the Voyager spacecraft at 130 astronomical units, if my thing that I'm measuring, and I want to confirm that it doesn't change as a function of distance, and I get the same number at nanometers all the way up to billions of miles, for it to suddenly change its gravitational constant at some other range, when you're going through that many ranges of, that many dynamic ranges, that many octaves of distance, you've gone a zillion octaves, and it stays constant, and then all of a sudden at some other magic number of octaves, it's going to change. Boy, where does the intelligence for those gravitons come from to do that? Over to you, Roy, KQRW.
Well, one of the interesting, strange theories out there is that although we think we live in a four-dimensional space-time, we're actually embedded in an 11-dimensional space-time. And some of the dimensions are curled very tightly, perhaps with a radius of a Planck's length. And so a lot of these guys think that if you get closer and closer to the curvature of the extra dimensions, you will see strange things happen to gravity, and they would like to use that also as an excuse of why gravity seems much, much weaker than all the other forces. If you line up all the four forces in the universe, each of them, for the first three, the strong nuclear force, the electromagnetic force, and the weak nuclear force, are orders of magnitude of 1,000 times weaker in as you go down. And then all of a sudden you get to gravity, and it's 10 to the minus 35. That's 1 over 10 with 35 zeros. That's damn weak. So, again, people are wondering why the heck it's weak. Of course, the relativistic guys say because it's not a force. But, you know, guys who are into quantum mechanics really want those extra dimensions.
And if it didn't have that number, plus or minus a small amount, we wouldn't have the universe, galaxies, superclusters, planets, suns, asteroids. We wouldn't have the stuff that we've got if it wasn't very close to that number.
There's a lot of arbitrary binding force numbers and mass numbers that apparently the universe has picked out of a hat that is compatible with a stable universe. That troubles people a lot. It brings them into religion sometimes, and other times it brings them into the possibility that there are a near infinite number of universes where these arbitrary constants are jumbled around. And in the ones where a stable universe can evolve into sentient creatures who say, how can this be happening to us, is just the anthropomorphic solution to that question.
I guess there are people who believe that at different portions of this universe, maybe in different galaxies, that all the constants are different numbers. I'm having trouble with that. How about you, Roy?
I don't think people feel that way, because if that was the case, then they would see a lot more weirder things out of their telescopes. I think it's a much more dubious concept that it's not galaxies, it's universes. You know, there is a metaverse, and we're just one universe of trillions and trillions and trillions. And in individual ones that we have no access to, the binding energy is slightly different, and the entire universe blew up within the first microsecond of its inflationary stage. That's the gist of what I get from these people. I don't think that they think that most of the arbitrary constants are different in the universe, in our universe, but I think they really would like gravity to act strangely at the edges. So they're really having problems with dark energy, as well as it strikes me as the phlogiston of the 21st century.
Do you have any trouble believing, Roy, that there are massive objects outside of our observable universe? And if you do accept that there can be massive objects, other galaxies, other universes, beyond our observable universe, therefore the material that's out at the perimeter of our observable universe could be sensing the gravitational attraction, I'm going to call it, of that other material, and that could create acceleration of the material out at the edges of our observable universe. We call that dark energy. We think it's a repulsive force. It could be an attractive force of the stuff that we have good reason to believe is out there, because out at the perimeter of our observable universe, the amount of material there didn't go to zero. It's not the end. Oh, you, Roy, K2LAW.
Well, the devil is always in the details. I believe that the observable universe is a subset of our universe. We're limited by the light cone and the speed of light in what we can visualize. Beyond it, I think, are a whole bunch of other galaxies. How many more? Is it twice the number? 10 times the number? 1 billion times the number? No one in their right mind can definitively tell you. There have been theoretical physicists who have guessed every single number in the number line. So I believe that it's possible. I tend to think, though, that they're isotropic, that they're basically the same density, and so the forces cancel out, and so for me it doesn't really supply me with a decent explanation of the incredible accelerating force at the outskirts. And that kind of brings up an interesting subject of infinity and such. Let me drop. A couple of weeks ago you mentioned about infinity, and if space-time ended, what would the wall be made of? It's a matter of semantics, I guess, but if you think about it, if there's a certain place where there's no space and time, you don't really need a wall, because say you go up to the edge of space and time, how do you get past that boundary point? Not that it's a wall, not that it's a brick, not that it's a shell, not that it's anything. It's just you run out of time when you reach the edge of space-time, if such a thing exists.
If I send a rocket out there at a very high velocity, and it gets to that edge that you've just described, but it's still moving at a high speed, what's going to stop it? Over to you, Roy.
It won't have any time to travel through at that point.
Yeah, that's similar to what's going on at the period of inflation. When you start taking what we call time, I mean, one definition of time is it's a man-made concept that gives quantitative order to the sequence of events. And we measure it with a watch, so to speak, a clock. So you're telling me that time moves at a different speed when it comes to the period of inflation, and you're telling me time either doesn't move at all or moves at some other crazy speed
out at the edge of mass time, whatever we're going to call it. Why these sudden discontinuities in those two different cases? In the beginning, at the end, we have this huge discontinuity, and yet for a whole lot of octaves in between, a whole lot of decades, everything is linear. I'm troubled when you have a whole lot of octaves of linearity, and suddenly the linearity breaks down. Where does the intelligence come from to say, at this magnitude, you're going to suddenly break down, even at all other magnitudes, you're perfectly linear? Over to you, Roy, K2IW.
Well, but you know, with electronic components, there are ranges of linearity and ranges of non-linearity, and it could be a very, very, very long linear region and a very, very short non-linear region. I mean, you can kind of do that with all kinds of things. Take something simple like biology. Okay, we all started, we're all kind of sitting there talking on the radio. We have trillions and trillions of cells. There was a time that we had less cells. So I guess theoretically you could poise a concept that we started as a single cell. But we really didn't start as a single cell. We started as an egg cell and a sperm cell. And there's no easy logical way to come to that conclusion. You have to find it out experimentally. So there's a lot of end conditions, unfortunately, that aren't the same as the middle region. The problem that I have is if you define an area that is devoid of space-time, because you can't just say that it's empty space, because then it's still part of your universe, because it's empty space. It has space-time, it has fields, and when something gets to it, it just keeps going. But if you're going to theorize an area that truly, utterly has nothing, then it can't have time at all. It can't have space. It can't have time. I consider time to be causality. One thing causes another thing, causes another thing, causes another thing. We use clocks and such to artificially measure them for us. We use the vibrations, the oscillations of crystals and of molecules and all kinds of fun stuff. Time is one of those great things that if you take it apart semantically, you drive yourself crazy.
You felt that the material out there beyond our observable universe is homogeneous. Well, that's a relative word. The cosmic noise background pictures that we've taken recently, Planck, for instance, shows the degree of non-homogeneity, non-uniform. I'll admit that the variation is very small. It's microkelvins and nanokelvins, but it's different. But still, it is not completely homogeneous. If I took all the mass of the Earth and I made it into a thin shell, and I climb inside that shell, I would be in weightlessness, unless the shell had some lumpiness to it. And then when I'm near one of those lumps, I'm going to sense some gravity from the inside pulling me out. Therefore, any non-uniformness of the material out there beyond our observable universe has the ability to create the attraction that we're calling dark energy. Over to you, Roy, K2IW.
Yes, but it has to be a sustainable, significant difference at a reasonable distance from you. As the distances get farther and farther and farther away, and the discrepancies from uniformity kind of blend together, because they average out over space as well, it kind of makes any kind of force, in my imagination, negligible. It's the same reason why you don't see shorter range gravitational forces just due to clumping of things. I mean, there's a lot of stars out there. We're not running towards them because they're far away.
The dark energy really only exists beyond something like 8 billion light years. Inside of that, the material is showing attraction. It only has this repulsion beyond 8 billion light years. And as you go further out, the repulsion gets stronger and stronger. Well, the material out there is getting closer and closer to those lumps. That's a possible explanation. Over to you, Roy.
Hotel India.
It's Hotel India.
Hey, thanks. Really interesting conversation between the two of you. That's just a quick test on my radio. I've been reprogramming it. W4HI, name's Bruce, B-R-U-C-E.
Hey, Bruce, glad to have you aboard. Maybe we could veer into some of the points that you made in your email about the angular momentum of the sun.
That's your choice. And if you want to go to another subject, and we got to keep an eye on leaving some time for the space report. Over to you, Roy.
Well, yeah, I already started this particular subject. It was about how the photosphere is slowing down in spin. I figure we'll do it for about 5 minutes and then hand it over to Paul.
Please proceed.
Okay, so Dick had some great ideas of possible ways that the angular momentum of the sun is being dissipated in its radiation. Electromagnetic radiation, solar wind mass distribution, gravitational wave generation, and neutrino generation. Part of the research this week is heavily on photons, that photons couple the angular momentum of the photosphere and dissipate it. About 20 years ago, there was this great theory about dust particles and photons from the sun striking the dust particle, decreasing their angular momentum, and then the dust particles fell into the photosphere and slowed down the sun's angular momentum. This week, they think that the photons alone can simply couple and reduce angular momentum. Solar wind. I would think that one of the big ways of dissipating angular momentum is from the solar wind dissipating it, and there have been articles in the past about it. Apparently, they don't really think it's significant enough, and they don't put it on their number one, two, or three list, so I'm kind of confused at that, but that's as far as solar wind. Gravitational wave, I unfortunately don't think so, because you need two gravitational objects kind of moving around, and the sun is kind of homogeneous in its core, so I don't think it really dissipates too many gravitational waves. Now, neutrinos might be interesting. They've done some research on a theoretical basis, but they haven't really published anything useful. So their best bet is electromagnetic coupling.
Let's back up a second. Is there strong evidence that the total rotational energy of the sun is slowing down, or is it just some kind of a
repeater, timeout.
Or is it just kind of some kind of a funny function of the photosphere or the corona? So what is slowing down, and is it slowing down a whole lot, easily measurable, or are we talking about over billions of years? How much slowdown of the sun rotation are we talking about here, Roy? Go ahead.
Okay, the studies basically are the photosphere. They're able to actually calculate it because the sun kind of rings. There's sonic waves that run through it, and you can actually do seismographic studies and see how the waves are distorted by the motion in the photosphere. It's very slowing down. It would take the entire age of the sun before it got down to any kind of appreciably low rotation. And it's not the core. The core kind of, they believe, is not slowed down that much. There's some drag going on. But this is primarily a phenomenon, they say, of the photosphere.
Okay. The photosphere, I am guessing, is just the outer thin layer of the sun that has all the brightness that we see when we take a picture of the sun. That may only be a couple of percent of its total mass. And so the photosphere slowing down, where the core is not slowing down, that could be another one of these cycles. You've got an 11-year cycle each half. You've got a 22-year cycle when it comes to the solar cycle, as we call it. But there could be another cycle in there where the photosphere speeds up and slows down. And maybe it's got a period of 1 million years. So if the core is not slowing down and only the photosphere is slowing down, explaining it may be difficult, but is it significant? Over to you, Roy, KGRIW.
Again, it's probably not significant. You shouldn't invest in gold and you know, rocket ships to get you out of the solar system, because even if it went at the same rate continuously, it wouldn't have an effect until long after the sun would go out. So, no, it's more of a scientific study of why the photosphere appears to be slowing down. They try to make it work with the solar winds. They don't feel that they could do that. They tried a little bit with neutrinos. They didn't think they could do that. They had different ways of explaining how photons could do it. And, you know, they've been knocking this around for at least 30, 40 years. But the new research suggests the direct coupling of photons. Now, is it possible that in 1 million years the actual photosphere is going to speed up? Yeah, I guess so. There could be a lot of other forces going on that we're totally unaware of. But I, you know, just thought it was interesting because I don't think of photons having angular momentum, and it got into the concept that we had earlier of black holes tonight. Okay, so unless anyone has anything else to say, I think it's time for Paul. Oh, I'd love to hear your space report tonight.
One quick question. If the photosphere rotation is slowing down, where could we read more about that, Roy?
Let me see if I put it on my list. I have a list that I will publish. Yes, I have it on my list. And as soon as the TechNet ends, I will publish it. And anyone can go to roy.ac2gs.com. And there's a place to click, and you can read all about it.
Well done. Okay, thank you. Paul, WS2N, I know that we've brought some astronauts, cosmonauts. We brought some people from the International Space Station back down this week, and I bet a lot more is taking place. WS2N, K2RIW. Go ahead, Paul.
Oh, yeah. This is WS2N. Scott Tingle, he returned, as well as Noshiga Kainu, he's from the Japan Aerospace Exploration Agency, JAXA. And, he came down with the commander of the Soyuz. Of course, he's Russian, and successfully landed in Kazakhstan. And that was early this morning, so I did see the replay. So they landed upright again, two times in a row. 50% of the time they land on the side and they have to open up the hatch and, bring them out. They'd rather have them land upright. It's easier for the crew. When they land, they don't roll around. And it's easier for the people to get them out. They bring this rig over, this aluminum rig, and it's got a slide on it, and steps, and it looks like a kid's slide. And they put the whole thing over the spacecraft, and they climb up, pull out the astronauts, and put them on a slide, slide them down, put them in these beach-type chairs, and they off to the medical facility. They have this blow-up building that they blow up. They bring them in there, and then they go back to their respective countries. So that was successful. And now there's only three up on the International Space Station. A couple of days from now, they'll be launching another three up. And they're going to be launching, of course, one Russian as the commander to fly the Soyuz up there. And you're going to have astronaut Alex Gerst. He's from Germany, but that's been trained by NASA in Texas. And that's where he wound up with his call letter, KF5ONO. And they'll be operating the Ares.